and then he edited them with that contour effect digitally, and then lit it to bounce the light off intentionally, so that when it was photographed, which is the final piece, it appears as if it's pixelated, that there's something not quite right, and then you look up close in the photograph and you realise it's made up of all these carefully cut out contours, layered upon one another. But what's interesting about his work, it reminds me of what you said about to what extent we're invited into the process of the work. And with his scenes, he almost always destroys them, so there's not a trace of the original scene. Yet, Prada Foundation has managed to purchase his scene Grotto, where they've displayed it within the Prada Foundation in Milan. So you can see like all of the card that's had that like contoured effect. So you can see it in its entirety, which is pretty stunning, pretty incredible to see, such a rarity for his work. So you can see that alongside the photograph that he shot for it. So yeah, I could imagine that being an interesting port of call, but with, again, his comment on the digital and the analogue and our relationship to it. But then also we're seeing the life model who is created in that way. Again, it reminds me of our earlier discussion of the landscape and the body, and how often things that we can find aesthetically pleasing within the landscape have a funny way of relating to the body. So I saw the body there as a landscape, thinking of a contoured map. But also, it seems interesting that you've worked with MDF, which is such an artificial version of the natural, which again is linked to the use of the digital, that these in some ways could be sort of artificial versions of the natural, and to what extent are these things real and how much do they replicate what's there, in some ways introducing similar questions that we were asking when photography was originally introduced. To what extent is this them? In some ways these can be seen as three-dimensional photographs, so I could imagine you taking a lot from photographic theory here and representation.
I will. It's more retrofitting than... I actually had a one-to-one with Stephen Farthing, who's the one of the chairs of drawing at the University of Arts at Chelsea. Interestingly, he lives in Mexico and he comes over here for about 3 weeks at a time and goes back with his wife's diploma. I went to one of his lectures at the University of London, and I picked up on a couple of things that he said, which I thought was quite controversial relative to what I was doing. So that sparked a conversation with someone about that. He thought I should consider going back to the touching, the painting, that I should do something like that, but touching the sculpture. Because he thought that touching a sculpture was more a natural thing to do than touching a painting. So anyway.
It's so interesting within the gallery.
Yeah, harder to do.
We often have that predicament where often within the gallery we feel the need to touch the object to understand it, but then there's also that phrase, you can look but you can't touch, mm-hmm. within the gallery, where if we touch the object or the sculpture and the alarm goes off, or we get told off by security, or we're asked to leave, and so there's such a sort of push-pull there. But also I must mention, with regards to the life drawing model who you'd be situating in this arena to facilitate a conversation, and in some ways that conversation being integral to the work and the idea. There's an artist, I hope I get his name right, Faisal Abdu Allah.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah, I don't know if you'd seen that, his hairdressing.
Yeah, but he used to do hairdressing in Brixton many
years ago. Okay. Oh,
and then he studied and so on. But I'm not aware of what he's done lately, funny enough, but that's someone that I'm going to be researching as well. But.
Great, yeah, I can imagine him being of interest, actually. But it's interesting with regards to this too, of how he's referred to, he's whenever he's asked what he does or who he is, he says, "Oh, I'm an artist and a hairdresser." And so his barber practice he considers incredibly important. Like he used to, I don't know if he still does, but he used to have his art studio underneath his barber's. And he considers the two incredibly important, so he still cuts hair now, but he did a performance at Tate Britain where he would cut people's hair with an audience that everyone would be gathered around. But the reason why he loved it so much, it seems similar to the reason why you're interested in this scenario here, which was to facilitate a conversation. Because he often noticed within the haircutting that people would suddenly open up and suddenly start talking about things that they would never talk about if they'd sit next to someone on the bus or chat with a cashier. And so he considers the opportunity of conversation incredibly important and connecting with people. So he's done that quite a bit, but he did it at Tate Britain, this performance. So people would go up, everyone would be gathered round, and they'd have a microphone.
So he kept talking while he's giving the haircut.
Yeah, and then the people would start.
Some of the exhibition haircut, because they're going for competitions, aren't they?
Yes, right.
That basically they are a piece of art, aren't they? Mm-hmm. The hair, I'm not quite sure I'll do much with mine, but you know, it definitely is. So I can see that.
I think that you know that conversing element somehow, because you know the customers, they are allowing someone to touch your hair, that kind of suddenly kind of feels close to this person, so that I guess as a hairdresser he gets granted that kind of closeness, openness. So it's like a observing,
quite
understanding the person. Yeah, it's quite intimate. So it's a bit like that's like an opposite of portrait almost. That process, isn't it? So that's I guess the name, because you start a series of portraits, isn't it, of you know, those kind of guys starts. And I think he came to give a talk 3 times here.
Oh really?
It seems so good.
Just about also about hair and conversation and culture, and then again it all links back to you know interest.
And isn't it these parties that you have and this situation that you've set up here, and then with Faisal Abdu Allah, like it's similar to the art institution as well, that it creates an arena where we can talk about these things, where we can have an opportunity to talk or gather around, like this situation here. Is in some ways doing the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to try and kind of work out, as you said, a hairdresser has permission to touch, so therefore they kind of let into your life a bit more, because it becomes a bit more personal. And I'm trying to figure out, well, how can I persuade people to touch the painting or the object? And I noticed that I was in Australia when my son was in Sydney. And basically, I was walking around the botanical garden, quite interestingly, there's a notice on the grass, and it says, please walk on the grass, which is exactly the opposite. So I thought I'd have a little notice which said, please walk on the grass. And when they walked on the grass, I'd actually get the moderator to say, you're allowed to touch.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
but that brings us back to the tutorial that on Tuesday about interactive art and with Jonathan about he's mentioning about some an exhibition at the V&A where it's a digital exhibition took back in 2010 and there's some things where people were allowed to touch and the for instance one for the entity toes but a hairdryer that made this sort of animated dandelions when it floats away, but people sort of bash the broken hairdryers. And so it's a case of at what point do you control what they can do, the audience can do, and how you manage that. And also you've got to be prepared that if you're going to get them to touch it, you might have to expect that it might get damaged in some
Well, I wouldn't know what to do with a big painting anyway.
Yeah.
I've got rubbing my hands.
And it reminds me in some ways of the frustration of the film and the photograph, where, again, you're in a situation where you're denied the ability to touch the object or understand it. Similar to the gallery. It's always held at bay. You're just left with the two-dimensional image. So then, no matter how peculiar a material looks, you can never fully grasp it. So there's always something held back.
True.
Yeah. But it's interesting as well that it seems to have really sort of opened up. I can see what you mean about the playfulness, like with this engineered situation that you have, where it started to, as you said, become a lot more experimental. And I think it can so often happen in artistic practices where things just suddenly open up, and then it's like, oh, actually, I can go over here, and then it opens up again, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to move back.
It gets even more experimental when I get onto the digital side.
Yes, yeah.
Did you go to the Alexander McQueen exhibition?
Yeah.
Savage Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically they were using a Pepper's Ghost technique within a pyramid. Did you see that? Cape?
Yes, yeah.
It was very ephemeral, did you see it? And it was great to see. And I thought, I would do that. So I've gone to Kickstarter and I've ordered something, which is a desktop version of that pyramid. And we're playing with that. So that's my kind of... Because I'm interested in three-dimensional things coming out as three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Because perspective on painting or drawing is in some way, well, it's artificial, isn't it? You're creating, you're pretending that it's a 3D object. It isn't. You make it look like one. But I want to be able to have my art, if you like, so you can, even if it's within the digital domain, in that respect, you could walk around it and you could see the pond.
Mm. And again, playing into the trompe l'oeil or the mirage, or sort of luring the viewer into a trap of expectation, where the rug is pulled under their feet of what they expect to be there or expect to experience. But it's interesting you should mention the V&A as well, because they held a conference recently on 3D printing. And the dilemmas that the institution has with regards to 3D printing. So they, all these cans of worms of questions, like if they have the digital file to save on space, could they destroy the work and then reprint it when they need it for an exhibition? And then it would make things a lot more cost effective if having an exhibition overseas to destroy it in one country and then recreate it in another.
Whereby lots of things that don't get seen, probably it's like the tip of the iceberg when you go to the museum or gallery or whatever, you're only seeing what's at the top. Like, so there's loads of other things that you don't see. But if you could actually see, let's say, an image of a sculpture and walk around it in the same way that you would do, and you could actually say, well, I'd like to see Rodin, whatever, and you could. Could get some feel for it. Anyway,
But they're such interesting questions that it, so much to play with. I think it's such a key area that's around us at the moment, and these questions need to be asked, and they can help reinform what we do value and why, and what we value in objects. And
I think the issue for me, though, is I have to stop getting so excited about the technology and remember that I'm trying to produce a piece of art.
Yeah.
That's me.
I'm kind of art. you can see I'm into technology.
Yeah. But then your interest in the technology is so part of it. It's fundamental to it. And your... the particular things that you find interesting about the technology are so it, and they're so things to play with and to pursue and to question and to entertain and to play with. So it's, yeah. Great, thank you all so much.
Well, thank you, yeah.
It's been
really annual. Yeah, no, it's been great, yeah.
Oh, lots of cancer worms of practice.
That's how it should be.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks. Oh, yeah. And good talk, good hot focus for help that I'm aware of.